So, 2 Kings chapter 18, and last week we were looking at Hezekiah's revival, and whenever Hezekiah became king, he took over from his wicked father, who had closed up the temple and stopped any kind of worship of God. He had stopped the sacrifices and the priesthood and all of that. So whenever Hezekiah became king, he hit the ground running and was working on turning the nation back to God and bringing them back to worship. And during this time, he saw Assyria invade Israel. And so Assyria was just right in the neighboring country. They had came into Samaria, besieged it for 3 years while Hezekiah was king in Judah. And he had watched them fall. He had watched them be carried away captive. And so that would have been something that would have caused him to have a lot of pressure on him, would have caused him to have a lot of fear, and would have caused him to struggle. And so with that, he is still very young, and he is learning how to trust God and how to follow him. And so anyway, whenever we get down to 2 Kings chapter 18, when we get to 2 Kings chapter 18, we're going to start reading down in verse number 13. And after the times of all of these revivals and everything that was taking place, Assyria was finished with Israel, and they turned their attention to Judah. It was kind of the next reasonable step for them to take as they were going and conquering, expanding their territory, was to go just to the next nation over. And so that's what we're going to start with tonight in 2 Kings 18 and 13. It says, "Now in the 14th year of King Hezekiah did Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria to Lachish, saying, I have offended, return from me. That which thou puttest on me I will bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and gave it to the king of Assyria." And so as we begin looking at this passage, like I said, Assyria turned their attention to Judah after they had defeated Israel. And Hezekiah responded to their threats and their attacks by agreeing to pay tribute to them. There's no place where it says that he sought after the Lord, that he went to the prophets, even though Isaiah was there. There's no sign whatsoever that he was going and trying to get God's mind or his heart in this matter. And instead, he just kind of went to a default of trying to ease the tension in any way possible, because he saw what Assyria was capable of. He was fearful, and so he just gave in. And he went so far as stripping the temple of the gold and of the silver, taking away the riches that were in the temple to give it to Assyria for them to stay away. And the bad thing about this is that we see plenty of kings that do this. But there was plenty of examples in Israel and Judah's past that if they would call out to God and if they would seek him in the day of trouble, then God would answer and God would help them. He would fix the issue. But that wasn't Hezekiah's first response. And so from this point onward, the account here in 2 Kings isn't purely chronological. What we deal with in chapter 18 is the issue with Assyria. And then we move on to Hezekiah's sickness and Hezekiah's recovery and the miracle of the sundial moving backward 15 degrees and all of that. And then also whenever the Babylonians come and he shows all the wealth of the people to the Babylonians. Y'all remember all that? Okay, and so it's not purely chronological. It's a little bit more topical, okay? Because if we continue reading in this, I'm not going to as of right now, but if we continue reading in this, what we find is that it says, whenever it talks about Hezekiah's illness and recovering all of those, it says, in those days, chapter 20 and verse 1, in those days. And then, as we go, well, there's other times that it says, in those days, it was at the same time. So these events were overlapping. They were happening during the same time frame. So Assyria was a continuing threat, continuing problems with the nation of Assyria. And during that time, these other events took place. And as we study it out just a little bit, we find out a little bit about what was going on while they were struggling with Assyria. And it seems like because of his lack of faith and the way that he compromised with Assyria, not calling on the Lord and stripping the temple and doing all these things just to appease the Assyrians, it seems like that could have been the reason why Hezekiah ended up having the sickness. Okay, that makes sense? And so anyway, because he had done this, placated the Assyrians, and didn't trust God, God allowed a sickness to come upon Hezekiah to where Hezekiah had nothing else that he can trust, nowhere else he could go except for God. Because whenever Isaiah comes to him, and we read about that over in chapter number 20, when Isaiah comes to Hezekiah, he says, get your affairs in order because you're going to die. That makes it pretty plain. This is the man of God. This is the prophet of God. God says you're going to die. Get things ready. And so this was in the 14th year. It was the same year that this happened with the Assyrians. In the 14th year, he was supposed to get his house in order because he was going to die. If we do the math, his son Manasseh would have been about 7 years old at this time. And part of getting his house in order would have been appointing his successor, the next king, which the logical one would have been Manasseh, even though he was 7 years old. Mm-hmm. So scary prospects.
Yeah.
But anyway, whenever this message is carried to Hezekiah, it says that Hezekiah turns himself on his bed to the wall and begins to pray to God. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to go through and read his prayer and whatnot. But he goes back and he recounts the promises that God made to the people of Israel and to the kings of Israel and how they were to handle themselves, how they were to do. And he holds on to that, recounting how he's trusted God, how he's led the people in worship, how he's done that which was right. And he is appealing to God to extend his life, to have mercy on him, so that the line of David would not be ended, so that he can continue ruling, and so God would be glorified. Okay? And so that's what he prays to God. And before Isaiah is even off of the compound, before he's even through the gates, God reveals to Isaiah that he has had a change of heart because of Hezekiah humbling himself before the Lord. Okay? And so Isaiah is told to turn around, go back to Hezekiah, and let him know that God has decided to extend his life by 15 years. I wonder if he had a calendar somewhere, like a countdown somewhere.
No.
Knowing he had 15 years, and so he gets down to that last one, he's like, I better make it count. But anyway, he's told you have 15 more years. And Hezekiah says, well, what's the sign that I go up to the temple? They put the lump of figs on and different things. The boil goes away. He goes to the temple. He offers up the offerings. He praises. He glorifies God. And he's healed. But the sign that he gets is for the sundial to go backward. So basically, the sun goes backward in the sky. Instead of continuing its normal path, it goes backward. So maybe the Lord actually changed the rotation of the earth just for Hezekiah, right? Just to give him a sign, showing him that there is nothing too hard for God, right? Because even the sign was something for Hezekiah, because just to get ahead of myself a little bit, all that Hezekiah is going through is God preparing and teaching Hezekiah because of the battles that's ahead of him, okay? So his first response, whenever the even though he was a godly king, he was leading the people in worship. He was going to church. He was reading his Bible. He was a good Christian here, so to speak. But he was just kind of going through the motions. It never really became real to him. He'd never really had a struggle. He'd never really had a trouble. He'd never really had a real challenge to him. And whenever that challenge came, he buckled, he caved, he ended up making the people of God tributaries to the Assyrians, right? And so because of that, God put him in a situation where he had to trust God. And in some things that we would have said was bad, I mean, he was sick unto death. And he was warned, you're going to die. That's bad. But God was bringing good through the bad circumstances. God was teaching him lessons through the bad circumstances. Kind of like we can see with Job. Job learned a lot about God through the troubles that he went through. And at the end of Job's life, after he had went through all of those things, he had a fuller, more clear picture of God and a whole lot deeper faith and trust in God, right? Not only that, but it was recorded for us all the way down through time to read about and for us to deepen our faith and our trust with God. And so anyway, Hezekiah was able to see his sickness healed, and he was also able to see that God is even in control of the motion and the rotations and the movements of the planets and the sun and the earth and everything else. And so whenever he was afraid of Assyria, because they just defeated Israel, he knew that they had been defeated because of their sin. He told the people that when he was rebuilding the temple and leading people back to worship, right? And so he knew why they were carried away. He knew that he was leading Judah away from all of that and actually to worship God. But still, the Assyrians were scary. I mean, he was a young king. He was still in his 20s, early 30s, right? I guess at 14 years, he started reigning whenever I think he was 21. So he'd been like 35 at this time, right? And so at 35 years old, he's watching this superpower, this empire, just steamroll through the nations and conquer one after another. And when they come to him, he says, I would rather try to have peace with this wicked work than to try to fight it. Mm-hmm. And so he gives up ground to try to fight it, or to try to get peace with it instead of try to fight it. Okay, that was the wrong solution. But the lesson for us is that too often whenever we come through difficulty, yes, we may go to church and read our Bible, be good Christians, but whenever troubles come, then we try to find ways to get out of them, try to find ways to find peace in them rather than go through it and allow those things to draw us closer to God.
Yeah.
Right? And that's usually our prayer whenever something comes along in our life, yeah, is God, get me out of this.
Exactly.
God, fix this. Rather than God, teach me through this.
Right.
Strengthen me through this. Help me to become stronger in my faith through this. Help me to see you work mightily. Because if he would have went to God and said, God, the Assyrians are coming against us. We have no power to overcome them. God, do something. Show yourself in this. God would have showed himself and he would have been skipping these in-between steps, right?
Right.
If he would have approached it that way and said, God, I want you to show me yourself through these circumstances. I don't know what I'm doing. There's no way I can overpower them. There's no way I can figure this out. I see nowhere to go besides to you. And he could have saw God just wipe the Assyrians out like he'll do later on. But he had to learn some lessons about this first. And so God was happy to oblige teaching his children here. And so this is what happens. This is why he is seeing God heal. He's got power over his body. He's got power over disease and sickness and these kind of things. He's got power over the sun and the moon and the stars and the earth and the rotation of the earth and all those things. He's got power over all of these things. And so Hezekiah sees all of this. And so does that fix it?
No.
It doesn't fix it. Not completely. Because Hezekiah is still learning. He's enrolled in the school of hard knocks at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because as soon as he has recovered from this, because he started out in fear, turmoil, there's an enemy, there's all these things. But then he gets a visit. There's a delegation that is sent from Babylon, a far distant empire, okay? And they come all the way to Hezekiah to see him. I'm saying this from Hezekiah's perspective, okay? So the Babylonians come all the way to visit him, to wish him well because they had heard that he had been sick. And they come and they bring treasures and they come and bring presents to him and they come and tell him how great it is that he has been healed and that he has made well. And all of these things boost his ego because one problem that Hezekiah has is his pride.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so the fact that this delegation from a large empire far away heard about him, cared about him, sent presents to him, and the get well greeting and all these different things, it made him feel really good about himself.
Yeah.
After he had felt really little and really afraid, now it's going the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And Satan doesn't care what he's going to get you with, whether it is your fear, your pride, or whatever. He doesn't care as long as he gets you.
Exactly.
And so anyway, whenever Hezekiah sees these guys, he's not a very good judge of character. Okay? Whenever he sees these guys, he's just like, hey, they really think a lot of me. When in reality, what they were doing is they were sizing him up. They were trying to figure out what he had for treasures, what he had for army and soldiers, what kind of defenses that he had, because they had a common enemy, the Assyrians. And they were at a strategic place. And so now, because they brought these treasures and they had stroked his ego and done all these things, now they've kind of got a little bit of pull with him to try to draw him in to an allegiance with them against the Assyrians. And now that's going to appeal to him a little bit as well, because who's he afraid of? He's afraid of the Assyrians. And now he's got somebody else coming in who also doesn't like the Assyrians. And so before he was depending upon paying off the Assyrians, and now possibly he's got allies to help him fight the Assyrians, right?
Yeah.
And so because of this, he views them as a help. He views them as a friend. And he takes them on the grand tour. He shows them the silver and the gold. He shows them the temple. He shows them the army. He shows them the palace. Shows them everything. And he just lays it all out, boasting and bragging about all the things that God had done for him, but not giving God credit for it. He's saying, look at how great my empire is. Look at how great I am. You know how great I am because you came all this way to see me. All right?
Yeah.
And so while he's got the big head, he's all puffed up, and he sends the delegation on their way, Isaiah comes to see him, because now he's starting to get a little bit of rapport with Isaiah. It seems like through these events is when he gets to know Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because Isaiah comes, you're going to die. No, now you're going to live. Do this. Be healed this way. Have this sign. Have it. So he has dealings with Isaiah now, right? And so now Isaiah comes in. He says, oh, who are the guys I saw leaving? He says, oh, they were Babylonians. And they would have had an entourage. They would have had, you know, fancy chariots and all these different things. And Isaiah said, who are these guys? He said, oh, they're from a far country and they came all the way here to see me. And Isaiah says, well, what have they seen? And Hezekiah says, they've seen everything. I've showed it all to them. And Hezekiah responds by saying, all that you have showed them, they are one day going to come and carry away. They're going to one day destroy this place. They're going to carry away your children and grandchildren. And they are going to carry away the gold, the silver, all the things that you've shown them one day will be theirs. In other words, Hezekiah, you messed up. Talk about deflating, right? So he says, hey, they were so excited about me. They really liked me. And Hezekiah, no, they didn't like you. They were using you. And so that's what Isaiah tells him. And so about that time he's deflated, he realizes that he's not as well liked, as smart as he thought that he was, and all these different things. And so his pride is dealt with pretty swiftly. And it tells us in the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles 28, I think it is, about how God was dealing with his pride, that he was puffed up, he had been healed, he had been all these different things, and he was then inflated. So he went from a trial to a victory, and in that victory, it led to pride and arrogance, and that pride and that arrogance led him to do stupid stuff. But through all of these events that we have seen so far, God was using all of those to shape and to prepare Hezekiah, right? So whenever the problem was too big, was insurmountable, he couldn't fix it, he turned to God and God delivered, right? Whenever he was looking to the enemy, Babylon, for help, and he thought that he was going to get help from below, instead of from above, it was a mistake. He was getting friends where they were not friendly. Mm-hmm. Another mistake, right? And so all of these things are going together to teach Hezekiah lessons. Because as we've studied throughout the book of Kings, a lot of times what happens is the kings start out good and then go bad, right? And thankfully, Hezekiah is not one of those. He starts out really good, but he still needs some maturing. He needs some growing. And God puts him through different things, and he responds to those things correctly. And as a result, he grows, and God is able to use him mightily throughout the rest of his rule. And he ends well. He started reigning, if I remember right, he started reigning at 21, and that would have been 14 years later, he'd been 35. Okay. And so all of this that we're talking about tonight happened when he was about 35 years old. Happened in basically the same year. Okay. And so he had previously, before 35, been making agreements with the Assyrians and giving them gold and silver. He got sick. He got healed. Showed the Babylonians all everything that he had. And after that, he got to the place where he was a little bit more teachable. And so all these things were used to humble him, connect him to the right people. And so with what we've talked about so far, the lessons that I've got written down from these things is whenever we set out to serve God, we are going to face battles. As the saying goes, there is no testimony without a test, right? And so a lot of people have the idea, especially if you get into the prosperity gospel and charismatics and all of that, is you get saved and everything's smooth from there on out. Everything's rainbows and lollipops and all that. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case, because God wants us to grow. He wants to teach us. He wants us to learn. And not only that, is whenever we're trying to do something for God, when we're trying to live our lives in a way that pleases God, it's a way that does not please Satan.
Exactly, yeah.
And so it causes us to have a target on us. Satan doesn't mess with people who's not serving God.
Right.
You know, people out there who are doing wickedly, they can't blame the devil for it. It's just they're living carnally, they're living wickedly, and he says, I can't do any better with them than what they're doing for themselves.
Yeah.
But for a believer that is trying to glorify God with their lives, Satan is going to bring opposition against them. But we don't need to be afraid of Satan, because greater is he that is in me than he that's in the world,
yeah.
That God is even able to use the things that Satan does for our good and God's glory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just as we see in the book of Job.
Yeah.
So when we set out to serve God, we will face battles. Second thing is, God will allow things to come into our lives to correct us and to prepare us. Third thing is that the enemy will come pretending to be your friend.
Exactly.
Whenever Satan came to Eve in the garden, came as a serpent hanging in the tree, and that was before people hated the serpent. That was part of the curse.
Mm-hmm.
And so the serpent came to Eve pretending to be her friend. Comes asking questions, concerned about her, wanting to know what's on her mind. Yeah, half God said. Nah, God doesn't really care about you. He's not really looking out for your good. He's actually keeping something really good away from you. But hey, I'm leading you in the right direction. You need to listen to me. You need to do what I have you to do. And that's the way that the world would come to us, right? And the world pretends to be our friend and tries to slander God and tries to make it out as if their way is the best for us and to lead us in ways that's actually going to destroy us, right? And so whenever Babylon came, they said, oh, we're your friend. We're going to help you. And in the end, they're going to destroy him. And then the last thing I've got for our lesson so far is that ultimately, whenever we accept God's ways and continue seeking him, he's going to work all things together for good, right? Because in Hezekiah's situation, we could criticize him because of how he gave away all the stuff to the Assyrians. That was wrong. How he was prideful and allowed the Babylonians to use his pride and use his ignorance to get an advantage of him, right? We could look at those things and say, oh boy, Hezekiah messed up, didn't he? But God used those things to humble him, to teach him a lesson. And Hezekiah responded right to the things that God was doing so that God was able to grow him, to teach him, to direct him, so that by the end of this, Hezekiah is mightily leading the people of God. Okay, so there's a big change that takes place. And so after he finishes his classes there at the School of Hard Knocks, Assyria returns. And we're going to start reading down in verse number 17. And it says, "And the king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a great host against Jerusalem." So in other words, they're an army marching against the capital city. They're coming back this time, and they're not playing. And it says, "And when they were come up, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is in the highway of the Fuller's Field. And when they had called to the king, there came out to them Eliakim the son of Hilkiah, which was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph the recorder. And Rabshakeh said unto them, speaking out to Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? Thou sayest, but they are but vain words, I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom dost thou trust? Thou rebellest against me? That thou rebellest against me? Now behold, thou trustest upon the staff of this bruised reed, even upon Egypt." That's who Israel was trusting it, wasn't it? "On which if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, but unto all that trust on him. But if ye say unto me, we trust in the Lord our God, is not that he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and hath said unto Judah and Jerusalem, ye shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? Now therefore, I pray thee, give pledges to my lord the king of Assyria, and I will deliver thee 2,000 horses if thou be able to put, put riders upon them. How then wilt thou turn away the face of one captain of the least of my master's servants, and put thy trust on Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Am I now come up without the Lord against this place to destroy it? The Lord said unto me, go up against this land and destroy it. Then said Eliakim the son of Hilkiah, and Shebna, and Joah unto Rabshakeh, speak, I pray thee, to thy servants in the Syrian language, for we understand it, and talk not with us in the Jews' language, in the ears of the people that are on the wall. But Rabshakeh said unto them, hath my master sent me to thy master and to thee to speak these words? Hath he not sent me to the men which sat on the wall, that they may eat their own dung and drink their own piss with you? Then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language, and spake, saying, hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you out of his hand. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us, and this city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Hearken not to Hezekiah, for thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me by a present, and come out to me, and then eat ye every man his own vine, and every one of his own fig tree, and drink ye every one of the waters of his cistern, until I come and take you away into a land like your own land, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyard, a land of oil, olive, and of honey, that you may live and not die, and hearken not to Hezekiah when he persuadeth you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Hath any of the gods of the nations delivered at all his hand out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hena, and Iva? Have they delivered Samaria out of mine hand? Who are they among all the gods of the countries that have delivered their country out of mine hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? But the people held their peace and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was saying, answer him not. So I'll stop there. But in what we find here is there was a change that took place. Hezekiah began by sending presents, sending gifts, paying tribute to Assyria. Okay? And something happened here somewhere. Either Hezekiah had a change of heart after God's dealing with him and he rebelled because the messenger said, thou rebellest against me. right? Mm-hmm. Either he said, I am not sending you anything any longer, and they decided to come up against him, or because the Babylonians came and they smelled maybe a bit of an alliance that was taking place there, and they said, we're going to come in and defeat them before Babylon comes to help them. That's a possibility that Babylon provoked them. But it's also a possibility just that they had come and they had gotten their way the first time and they had gotten treasures. And here's what we find with the enemies of God's people. They are never satisfied. You give up a little bit, they're coming back for more later, right? Which king was it that the enemies came against and said, let us come and thrust out your eyes and then you can be our servants? And then they said, okay, well, we'll do that. You can thrust out our right eye and we'll be your servants. And then they said, well, let us come back and we're going to pass through your land, and anything that we see that we like, we're going to take it from you. And they said, well, we agreed with the first thing, but now you're wanting even more, and so we've got to stop this. You all remember that story? Okay. And so basically what was going on there is whenever they saw that they made a little bit of progress, they made a little bit of ground, these people are willing to give in. Well, we're going to see how far we can push them. And that's the way the enemy works, isn't it? And so whenever we look at this, I have a feeling it could have been all of the above. Okay, it could be his rebellion. He may have rebelled because of Babylon. But then at the end of it, they said, we're going to go and we're going to get everything they have, because Assyria is not going to be happy as long as Judah exists. Yeah. Okay, and the enemy is not going to be happy just because you give up a little. The enemy's not going to be happy because you compromise. The enemy's not going to be happy because he gains a little bit of ground. The enemy won't be satisfied until he destroys you. Right? Whenever we look at occasions of things like demon possession in the Bible, what did the demons have in mind to do to those that they possessed? What did they try to do? They try to destroy them. Any way possible. That was one of the characteristics of demon possession, is they tried to destroy whoever they possessed. And that's just an insight into the way that Satan works. He's not happy just to mess things up a little bit. He's not happy just because you skip a day reading your Bible. He's not happy just because you backslide just a little bit. He wants to see you destroyed. And this is what's going on here. The Assyria comes back against them and says, we're going to wipe you out. And so they come with their message for the people of Israel, or for the people of Judah. And they began speaking to the messengers of Hezekiah, the ones that came on his behalf. And they are shouting so that the people on the walls can hear, so the people in the city can hear. They're saying, here is the message from Assyria. We're going to come. We're going to bring our armies against you. We're going to overrun you. We are going to destroy you. And your little king Hezekiah up there, he's saying God's going to help you, but God's not going to help you, because your God isn't going to do anything. Look at all of the cities we've already wiped out. Look at how we wiped out Israel and Samaria. Their God didn't help them. Look at how we wiped out these other nations. Their God didn't help them, and so your God's not going to help you. He says, as a matter of fact, your God's the one that sent me over here to destroy you. I have come, and I am the servant of your God, and I'm going to wipe you out. And so they continue all of this talk, all of this nonsense, basically repeating the interaction that the serpent had with Eve in the garden. Okay? And so the servants of Hezekiah says, hey, quit speaking to us in Aramaic. Quit speaking to us in our language. Let's speak in the Syrian language so the common people can't hear what you're saying. He says, don't broadcast this. Don't make all the people afraid. And the guys become that much more brazen in their attack. And they say, we're going to speak to everyone, because this message isn't just for you or Hezekiah. It is for all the people that we are getting ready to destroy. So they are inciting fear. They are inciting discouragement and all these things in all the people, so that they will give up. They will give in without a fight and become servants to Assyria. That is their goal. But Hezekiah has learned his lesson. He's no longer going to bow to them. He's no longer give in. He's no longer afraid of them, because he has seen what God can do. He has learned his lesson through his time in the school of Hard Knocks, And so now he is not falling back into the same tricks. He's not calling out to Babylon. He's not calling out to Egypt, even though Assyria accuses him of doing it. But instead, he's calling out to God. And so the delegation here from Assyria, they go through a list of different things that Satan will try to do in our lives to try to cause us to stumble, to cause us to quit, try to get us to surrender. Okay? And the first thing that the messenger there from Assyria says, in verse number 19, he says that God won't help you. Verse 19, Rabshakeh saith unto them, speak now to Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? You've got a confidence in God, and God's not going to help you. Mm-hmm. That's what he's saying. And that's one of the thoughts that the devil puts in our head whenever we're struggling, whenever there's a difficulty, whenever there's a trial, is God's not going to hear my prayers. I've got this confidence in him, but is he worthy of my confidence? Is he actually going to help me? Is he actually going to do anything for me? Because then that brings about desperation. It causes us out of our doubt to try relying on self instead of on God, right? Isn't that the question? What confidence is this wherein thou trustest? Are you sure you can be confident in God? Well, I'm not sure. And if you're not confident in God, then where's your confidence go to? Yourself, right? And that is the tactic of the devil. Take your eye off of God, put it on yourself. Make it to where you don't believe, make your faith question. So you're no longer putting your faith in God, but you're trying to figure out a solution on your own. I don't know if God's going to come through or not, so I've got to figure this thing out. Right?
Yeah.
So doubt. The second thing that he uses is our failures. Down in verse number 22, this is a failure that they had perceived. Verse 22, it says, but if you say unto me, we trust in the Lord our God, is not that he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and has said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem. As the enemy was looking on, he says, you're claiming that God's going to save you, but you've destroyed his altars. You've destroyed his high places, right? Now, we know that he was doing that in the will of God, that God was only supposed to be worshipped at the temple of Jerusalem. But in the Assyrians' perspective, is the God that you're claiming to worship, you have been offending him, you have been failing him, you've been doing away with his altars, you have been doing away with his worship. And the way that relates to us is that whenever we're in a time of difficulty, uncertainty, whenever we're struggling, then we start questioning whether or not we are actually serving God right. Isn't that the question? What about your failures? What about where you've messed up? What about where you have not done this or where you have done this? And you start going through all of these different things. Because whatever they said, well, we're going to trust in God. They said, oh, you mean the God that you've offended? Oh, you mean the God that you aren't serving properly? Oh, the God that you're not worshiping? Oh, the God whose altars you've abandoned? Right? Mm-hmm. And so you start taking stock of your relationship with God and you start saying, oh, I failed here and I failed here and I've not done this right and I've not done that right. So because of that, God's probably not going to help me. The enemy resorts to outright lies. Verse 25. Am I now come up against you without the Lord against this place to destroy it? The Lord said unto me, go up against this land and destroy it. Did God tell him to do that? God might have sent him, but not to destroy it. Sent him to be destroyed, didn't he? But the enemy will use outright lies. Thou shalt not surely die. But the Lord knows that in the day that you eat thereof, you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. Satan is a liar and the father of it, right? And so it's amazing the lies that we believe in times of fear, in times of difficulty, in times of struggle. There's all sorts of lies Satan will make us believe. Whether it's God doesn't love you, or the people who do love you are out to get you, or no one actually cares about you, all these. There's all kinds of lies that come into our mind. It's all up to you. You've got to figure it out. You've got to come up with a solution. You've got to get the answer. You've got to do the... There's all sorts of lies. But in this case, he says, God sent me here to destroy you. You don't have God on your side. I've got God on my side. Then we see that there is also fear that's used by the enemy. Verse 26. And that's where they're trying to get the messengers to not speak in the Jews' language because they are inciting fear in the people. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And so in those times, we are fearful, we are afraid. And whenever we are fearful, we become overwhelmed with negativity.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. That's what the messengers was afraid of. The people are going to be overwhelmed with all these negative things that the enemy is saying. And this negativity is going to make them afraid. It's going to make them unable to stand, make them give in, make them give up.
Yeah.
And so there's fear because of this overwhelming negativity. There's discouragement. See, all these are closely related, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
There's discouragement. Verse number 29. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you out of his hand. It's a lost cause. You can't win. You may as well give up, right? There's also in verse number 31 and 32, I don't know if you caught this whenever I was reading it, it says, hearken not to Hezekiah, for thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me by a present, and come out to me, and then eat ye every man of his own vine, and drink every one of his, drink of his own vine, eat every one of his fig tree, drink of his waters of his cistern, until I come and take you away into a land like your own, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of oil, olive and honey, that you may live and not die. So this was the promise of Assyria. It said, come out, give in, let us have our way with you, and we're going to take you, allow you to stay in your land for this time, and then we're going to just transplant you into another land just like the one you're in now. Basically, what they're saying is just give up, surrender, and everything will be okay.
No.
Right? That's what the enemy's telling them. And so they give false promises. They want you to compromise, saying giving in to their way, to the world, to the devil, is good for you. It's better for you. It's going to ease your problems. It's going to take away the problems if you'll just do it their way. Right? And so that's what Satan wants us to believe. And so as we're going through in our Christian life, there are going to be difficulties. It's going to be difficult for us to be separated, for us to be different, for us to do what's right whenever the world's doing what's wrong, for us to be weird, right? There's going to be people who don't understand us. There's going to be people that criticize us, and the devil's going to come in and say, hey, if you'll just do what everyone else is doing, if you'll just fit in, everything will be okay. It'll be good for you, right? And so the seventh thing that I've written down here as we go through all of this is there's also hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
Verse 33, hath any of the gods of the nations delivered at all his hand out of the hand of the king of Assyria? He said, look around. What makes you think you're any better than all the rest of the failures?
Mm-hmm.
Look at everyone else who's given up. Look at everybody else who's lost. Look at everybody else who's given in. You think you're actually going to be able to hold out? You think you're going to be the exception to the rule? You think you're going to actually make it whenever everybody else is quitting, whenever everybody else is falling and failing and giving up? You think you're going to be the one to make it? Nah, you may as well just give up now. Why even fight? Right? Hopelessness. And these are the things that the enemy uses against us. It is a way of wearing down our mind, wearing down our hearts. And in the end, we lose our joy, we lose our zeal, and we lose our desire, and we end up just giving in and blending in with the rest of the world. We're not going to serve God. We'll be good people, but we're not going to be Christians. And that's the way a lot of people have went. Why are so many people turning away from God? Why are so many people walking away from church? Why do so many people seem as if they don't care? Why is it that no one's here on a Wednesday night? They've listened to the lies. What's the point? Why does it matter? Let's just give in. It'll be easier. It'll be okay. Right? But Hezekiah and Judah had learned to rely on God because of the things that God had led them through. And so the last verse that I read is that they held their peace and answered him not a word, because that's what the king told him to do. He said, the enemy's going to come. He's going to be talking to you. He's going to be trying to discourage you and trying to mislead you. And whenever he does, ignore him. Don't engage. Right? Because if you allow him to get a toehold in, if you allow a little bit of doubt, a little bit of discouragement to start working its way around in your mind, it gets bigger and it gets bigger and it gets bigger, and it's going to make you spiral into negativity, and it's going to make you spiral into fear and doubt and hopelessness, and it's going to take over your heart and your mind, and it's going to cause you to be extremely discouraged, and it's going to cause you to be overcome by the enemy. Right? And so the first thing that we see in this, in overcoming the enemy's tactics, is that we need to make sure that we're not engaging with him. If you go back to Genesis once again, whenever Eve was in the garden and the serpent came, how much better off would she have been whenever he started talking and asking questions if she would have just said, shut up and slither away? Was that not her problem, is that she engaged in conversation with the serpent? She gave space to it. The Bible tells us if we resist the devil, he flees from us, right? But if we converse with him, right? That's what we do in our minds, isn't it? We're conversing with the devil. He's whispering his lies in our ear. He's bringing all these accusations against God. And next thing you know, you're eating the fruit. Right? And so the first thing that Hezekiah tells him, don't engage, don't talk with it. Go over to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians 4, verse number 8. It says, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. So what we allow to ruminate in our mind, what we are thinking on, is going to make a huge difference in our direction. It's going to take a big difference in the health of our soul and our mind, our heart. Because if we are setting and allowing Satan to scoot up next to us and whisper in our ear, and those are the things that we're thinking on, what direction are we going to go? But if we're taking and we are thinking on, meditating on the things that are true instead of Satan's lies, the things that are good rather than the things that are evil, the things that are of a good report rather than everything that was coming in here was a bad report, wasn't it? If we're thinking on the things that are of virtue and that are of praise, that's going to completely change things, isn't it? And so he ignored and didn't engage. Second thing that we find in chapter 19, verse number 1, it came to pass when King Hezekiah heard it, that he rent his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, and he went to the house of God. Whenever the enemy was raging, he went to church. Right? Why does the Bible say, forsake not the assembling of yourselves together? Is it just something to guilt people with to get into the church house? No, it's whenever the enemy is out and prowling and seeking whom he may devour, Hezekiah shows us, go to the church house. Yeah. Right? That's why we don't forsake the assembling of ourselves together. And it says, and so much the more as you see the day approaching, the more evil it gets, the more necessary it's going to be to get back to where God's people are. Right? And so he went to church in verse number 1. He got in touch with those who knew God. It says, he sent Eliakim, which was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and the elders of the priests, covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet. Remember the trials that he went through and the mistakes that he made got him in touch with Isaiah?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever he was going to die and whenever he had his boil and whenever he had the mistake with the Babylonians, he got in touch with Isaiah and he saw that Isaiah was someone who knew God.
Right.
And so whenever he was going through troubles and trials, he got to church and he got around people who knew God. Right? Then the next thing that we see here is he kept the right perspective. Down in verse number 4, look at the way that he's speaking here. It says, it may be the Lord thy God will hear all the words of Rabshakeh, whom the king of Assyria, his master, hath sent to reproach the living God, and will prove reprove the words which the Lord thy God hath heard. Wherefore lift up thy prayer for the remnant that are left. And so Hezekiah's perspective on this is the enemy is not just attacking me. He's not just attacking my city. He's attacking my God. And if we are the children of God, whenever the enemy comes against us, the enemy is coming against our God as well. Right? If the enemy is attacking the sheep, he's attacking the shepherd as well, right? That's a different perspective, isn't it? Because doesn't Satan want us to feel as if we're all alone, as if we're by ourselves, as if God doesn't care and God's far removed?
Mm-hmm.
And we get the right perspective about this and we realize the enemy's not just coming against us, the enemy's coming against God.
Yeah.
You pick a fight with me, you pick a fight with him. That's a whole different perspective, right? And so that's what he's doing is he's going to the church house, he's getting around God's people and saying, hey, they are attacking God. Is that not what David did as well whenever Goliath was out there? And he looked at all the people and says, he's blaspheming against God. Is there not a cause? Right? He's not just bad-mouthing King Saul because, hey, everybody can do that. He's the coward over there that won't fight. But he's bad-mouthing our God.
Yeah.
And so he kept the right perspective. Fifth thing is he trusted in God's promises. Because as he went down through, he was going back to the things that God promised the people of Israel, the people of Judah. We have the one place where it says, if my people, which are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray,
mm-hmm.
seek my face, turn from their wicked ways.
Yeah.
Hezekiah is going through and he's remembering the promises that God made to the people of Israel. He did that whenever he was sick and needed healed. He's doing that again in these times. And so whenever we come down to verse number 6, Isaiah said unto them, thus shall you say to your master, thus saith the Lord, be not afraid of the words which thou hast heard, which the servants of the king of Assyria has blasphemed me. Behold, I will send a blast upon him, and he shall hear a rumor, and shall return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. So here he has a promise from God, right? And Hezekiah says, God has sent message to me by Isaiah. Don't be afraid. I've got this. He's going to fall in his own land. You're not even going to have to fight him. His death's going to be away from you. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I figure after he heard that, he had a little bit more confidence. He had a little bit more peace about him, right? And so he trusted in God's promises. And then he also prayed, laying it all out to God in verse number 14. Because there's a time here that God starts working in between verses 8 and 13. God starts working. They start having other battles and attacks. They're drawn away. They have to quit picking on Judah for just a little bit and go somewhere else. But he sends messengers back. Hey, I haven't forgot about you. I'm still going to come back and kick your backsides later on. That's basically what Rabshakeh does. And so whenever he gets this letter, see, these guys had to leave to go and take care of the battles that were coming against them. And so they send letters just to continue intimidating the people of Judah. So in verse 14, Hezekiah received the letter of the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up into the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord God. And Hezekiah prayed. I love this passage. This is one that's always stuck with me. I've always loved it because I can see this happening.
Yeah.
I've got a picture in my mind. He gets the letter. He opens it up. He goes to the temple, and he spreads the scroll out on the floor of the temple, and he starts praying and says, God, look at what they're saying about you. He just rolls it out. That's what it says here. He went up into the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. And he pours his heart out to God. He says, this is what I'm facing, God. Look at what they've done. Look at this situation. Look at what's going on. Just look at this mess, God. Do something about it. And so he prayed and he laid it all out before God. And that's something that I think we fail to do a lot of times. We've got all the cares and worries and burdens on us. And the Bible tells us to cast our cares upon him, for he cares for us. And we fail to actually lay our cares out before him. Find a place and pray and just be honest with God and just lay it all out before him. This is what I'm going through, God. I'm putting it in your hands. I'm leaving it for you to do something about it. And so that's what he does. And then the last thing that we're going to look at is that he saw his answer to prayer and his final victory. Okay? There's an answer that takes place here between verses 20 and 34, where God sends message from Hezekiah, or not from Hezekiah, from Isaiah to the Assyrians and says, you think that you're so big and bad, you beat all these other ones, but the only reason you had any power to beat them is because I allowed you to do it. But I'm going to lead you away from my people because they're trusting in me. I'm going to put a hook in your nose and lead you away. He assures the people of Israel, of Judah, and says, here's going to be the sign, verse number 29. This shall be the sign unto thee. Ye shall eat this year such things as grow of themselves, the second year that which springeth of the same, and the third year ye shall sow and reap and plant vineyards and eat the fruit thereof. What verse 29 is meaning there is the people had been so afraid of the Assyrians, and the Assyrians with their armies around them was keeping them from actually going out, planting, sowing, and harvesting. They were at risk of not having enough food. And God says, here's the sign, the reassurance I'm going to give to Judah that I've got this under control, is I'm going to make the ground bring forth enough of a harvest without you planting it to get you through until the harvest grows. And so that's what he promises them. He says, I've got you. I'm going to take care of you. You haven't been able to sow. You haven't been able to plant. You haven't been able to harvest. And so I'm going to make the land bring forth in handfuls where you haven't even planted anything and you'll be taken care of. And when we come down to verse 35, it says that it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote the camp of the Assyrians, 185,000. So that's 185,000 men. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. So they woke up dead. They woke up dead. Behold, whenever they woke up, they were all dead corpses. And so whenever Hezekiah spread all this before God, he said, I'm trusting you this time. I'm not going to pay them off. I'm not going to send to the Babylonians. I'm not going to try to figure something out. I'm laying it all before you. God says, okay, that's what I wanted from you. And he kills 185,000 of their army that evening. Gone. They're done. And so verse 36, so Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt in Nineveh. And it came to pass, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer, his sons, smote him with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Armenia, and Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. And so what we get at the end of this is because he was willing to ignore and refuse all the things that the enemy was saying, and instead trust in God, surround himself by godly people, reach out to God, pray, and trust him. God brought about a victory in a miraculous way to where at the end of it, Hezekiah could look back and say, there's no doubt it was God that did all of this. And so it worked out a lot better at the end, right? And so out of all the kings that we've looked at so far, Hezekiah is an excellent one. The Bible says over and over is that he was a man after in likeness of King David, right? He served God like David did. That he was one of the greatest, that there wasn't anyone before him that or after him that was greater than he was. Remember us reading that? Well, why was he so great? Well, he started off seeking the Lord. Troubles come. He had some struggles. He had some hiccups along the way. But God used those struggles and those hiccups to teach him and train him a little bit so that he would trust in God. And then from that point, he trusted in God and he got the victories. And he ended his reign well. The Assyrians learned not to mess with him. They fled. They were done, right? And he was able to rule for an additional 15 years after this, now with a new trust and a new faith in God and a new victory that he didn't have before. That enemy that was looming over him for the first half of his reign wasn't a problem in the second half because of the lessons that God showed him. Okay? And so that brings us to the end of Hezekiah. And in studying all this out, I was kind of glad to see the trajectory of his kingdom, because usually as we're reading Hezekiah's life, you know, chapter 18 is his battle with Assyria. Chapter 19 is, you know, he finally gets victory over Assyria. And then chapter 20, he gets sick, right? And then sometime later on after that, Babylon comes along. And we don't really look at the timeline of that and realize that chapter 20 took place in the middle of all of that. And that was a turning point in his life because of the way it was laid out, right? But it makes it pretty plain as we look at it and compare passage with passage when it happened. And that was the events that God used to shape Hezekiah so that he was able to lead the people and to trust God. So that being said, you guys got any comments?
We're looking at Sennacherib. I was thinking, what's the real stuff happened in the back of your family?
And the tradition in that is, or the what the record says, is not only did they kill him, but it was in the house of his God, and the idol fell over on him and crushed him. So yeah, that's the way they say that he died, is that they stabbed him and tipped the idol over on him and crushed him.
Your God will save you now.
So everyone was against him in the end, right? Okay, well, let's pray. Dear Lord, we come to you today. Just thank you for your blessings. We thank you for this time to be in church and in your word. And we just pray that you would help us through this passage, Lord, to realize that there is an enemy, Lord, but Lord, we have a God that is more than able to lead us and to take care of us through all these things, that we just continue to ignore his lies and ignore all the things that the enemy tries to make us believe, and that we just trust you and follow you. And Lord, we thank you for all that you do. Thank you for loving us. All these things I pray in Jesus' name, and amen.